You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of philanthropic programs, from big corporations aimed to help girls and women get out of poverty, but our guest says they don't always have positive effects on the people they're supposed to help. First, after some speculation, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says he's not ruling out a run for governor this fall. His potential candidacy was first reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Here he is responding to the stories last week on WITI-TV.
I've had people approach me saying, we would like you to be mayor. We'd like you to stay mayor. I've had people approach me and say, we'd like you to run for governor. And I have people who approach me who say, we'd like you to move to Tahiti. So it's all over the board, and we haven't made any decisions.
If he ran, it would be Barrett's fourth attempt at the office. He'd be entering a Democratic primary battle with 16 other candidates. Matt DeFore is a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's with us now to talk about what this all says about the race for governor this fall. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thank you for having me again.
Well, first of all, Mayor Barrett is not running, but he's not running. Do we have any kind of sign of when he might lay down a decision here?
No, and it's been very confusing because I think what we've been hearing over the last couple weeks, including last week when this news first broke, is that there's division within Walker's own political team about whether he should run.
In Barrett.
So, I'm sorry. Tom Barrett, yes.
Yeah.
Tom Barrett, obviously, like many of the other candidates running, would have many, there's pros and cons about a candidacy. And so there's a lot of questions about whether he would, even clear the field or, it's not clear that he would necessarily do that or where he'd fit into the mix.
And you talk to national experts and pollsters and other people about this. The one big plus you would have, it seems like, would be name recognition. A lot of people don't know who these other candidates are. Barrett, at least, has run at the statewide level before.
I think that's right. Although, again, some of that name recognition may come down to people just not having a favorable or unfavorable view of a candidate at this point. Maybe they're waiting to hear a lot more information. So Tom Barrett, when he was running in 2012 in the recall, we saw his sort of recognition improve. He started in January of that year and somewhere in the 40% range of people saying they didn't have an opinion about him, which is sort of how you gauge somebody's whether they're known or not. Right now, Tony Evers, at least in the latest Marquette poll, is at 66%. So there's a theory that maybe he would come in with much more name recognition. He certainly would, although I don't know if it would necessarily be as low as 12%, which is where he ended up right before the recall. It sort of remains to be seen how he would play in a poll.
How have Democrats been responding to the possibility of another Barrett candidacy?
Well, I think there's been a lot of... from the candidate's perspective, it's either, we'll see what happens. The attitude all along when any candidate comes in has been, somewhat the more the merrier, somewhat let's just kind of keep our head down and keep not being critical of anyone else. I think you sort of have opinions across the board, just like Mayor Barrett said in the clip.
Talking to Matt DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal about the race for governor in Wisconsin, a crowded Democratic field, and maybe Mayor Tom Barrett making another run for governor. Speculation on that right now. Matt, big picture on the race. You talked to some of the people who kind of handicap, who rate political races around the country. What are those people from outside of Wisconsin saying about what they're expecting in the state?
Well, first of all, many of them see this race as leaning Republican, which is sort of the one step removed from a toss-up, which would be a really competitive race that would get a lot of national attention. They see Scott Walker, at least even in this blue wave kind of year, as having a better than 50-50 chance of winning. But some of them said to me that's driven somewhat by the fact that we don't know who the nominee will be, how strong they will be coming out of the primary, how much money they'll have, how much support they'll have from large swaths of voters who don't even participate in the primary. So it's unclear. But what they're seeing with this Tom Barrett possibly thing, just the fact that he's thinking about it, it says two things really about the race potentially, or at least it signals a couple things. One is that this is potentially just not a very strong field, that he thinks he has the ability to come in here and sweep in at the last minute and win the nomination. Secondly, it also indicates potentially that Governor Walker is vulnerable. Otherwise, why would he be even thinking about it. So those are two narratives that have been there throughout this whole primary process, and the fact that he's thinking about it so late in the game just fuels those narratives.
What have we heard from Republicans about Barrett and then the crowded field of Democratic candidates?
Well, on Barrett, obviously, he's lost to Governor Walker two times already, so I don't know that they're too worried. Again, he like the other candidates, he would have positives. He's got money, he's got name ID, but he's got negatives. He's lost twice to Walker. You know, and we've seen other cases in this state where somebody runs multiple times against somebody. They don't necessarily do well because voters may say to themselves, well, I've already decided I didn't want that person to win the election. But again, it's a very different year. In terms of, you know, the Republicans also have all along, I think, been criticizing the Democratic field as not having any, you know, A-level candidates, although, you know, again, I don't know that the Democrats have the strongest bench, given Republicans have been in control of most of state government for the last 8 years.
One interesting dynamic, I don't know how this plays out, everybody knows who the Republican nominee is going to be. It's going to be Scott Walker, barring him making a very unexpected life decision at this point, I guess. And so Democrats can kind of concentrate their attacks on him. Nobody knows who the Democratic nominee is going to be. So until the primaries in August, Republicans don't really know who to focus their criticism on.
That's right. I think that may be even a strategy on the part of the Democrats. If you're a Democratic candidate who is, you know, not doing well in the polls, you may look at this situation and say, well, you know, it's better to have 9 or 10 or 17 people, you know, going around the state talking to Democrats, getting people enthusiastic about the election. And, you know, so they end up not getting the nomination, but maybe they've helped the nominee perform better during the general election.
A story in Democratic primaries going back to last year or the 2016 presidential election has been kind of the establishment wing, which was attached to Hillary Clinton a lot, and then the progressive wing, if you want to call it that, where people attach themselves to Bernie Sanders. Is there that kind of thinking going on here in Wisconsin with, you know, Mayor Barrett would be kind of the establishment Democratic candidate versus, I don't know, who fills that role among the crowded field of the outsider alternative?
I think, yeah, there's different roles. I think we hear the term lane a lot. A lot of these candidates are trying to find their lane. So there is a question as to what would the lane that Mayor Barrett would occupy if he were to get into the race. And, you know, some of the candidates, I think Mike McCabe, Paul Soglin, have at times talked about it in terms of, you know, their candidacy is going to have that Bernie Sanders kind of progressive edge. I don't know if you could argue that, you know, again, Tony Evers right now is seems to be leading the pack in most of the polls or all the polls, really. I don't know if that makes him establishment. I don't think he's necessarily going for that mantle. I think the Democrats are not trying to coronate somebody like they did in 2014 with Mary Burke. So, you know, what makes somebody establishment or not? I mean, it's possible that Barrett would be trying to fill that lane. You've also got Matt Flynn, who's a former party chairman, and you know, again, so there's a lot of people to rattle off. So we could, you know, I think, and everyone's trying to make an argument that they have one of these lanes that they occupy. So
sometimes, especially early in a race, when that bigger name candidate, higher profile candidate comes in, it kind of scares everybody else out. The donors concentrate around one person. From your report on this, it sounds like people don't think that would necessarily happen if Tom Barrett gets in this race.
Right. I think there's a lot of skepticism that, you know, when Paul Soglin got in the race in January, you didn't see people get out of the race at that time. I know recently he's been trying to talk about this race as a two-horse race now between him and Evers, based on, I think, a poll he did last week. But there hasn't been a lot of movement in the polling. I know Tony Evers was leading a poll that he did in January, and I think in the Soglin poll last week he was doing about the same. So I think people haven't really tuned in yet to this race to give one candidate a real sense that they're not going to make it or not. So, there's a lot to go here still.
It's a good place to leave it. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me.
That's Matt DeForest, State Capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about the latest in the race for governor. First, big corporations across the globe, such as Nike and Coca-Cola, all have philanthropic initiatives. In recent years, one of the most popular charitable campaigns from corporations has been to invest in women and girls in developing countries, the aim being to lift them out of poverty. Our next guest has been researching those programs and how well they work for her new book. She found that the goal of lifting girls and women out of poverty doesn't always work and doesn't always accomplish what the charity set out to do. Catherine Moeller is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies in the School of Education at UW-Madison. Her new book is The Gender Effect, Capitalism, Feminism, and the Corporate Politics of Development. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's a lot of this kind of philanthropy going on, you write. A lot of companies have embraced this idea of the girl effect is one of the names for it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so for more than a decade, companies like Nike, Goldman Sachs, and ExxonMobil have been investing their corporate philanthropic funds in programs for girls and women in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And they've been doing so in order to generate what they call a ripple effect, from the scale of the girl or the woman, to even to the scale of the nation. And the idea is that it reduces poverty, increases economic growth, decreases child and maternal mortality, limits population growth, conserves environmental resources. And as you said, the girl effect has really brought this idea into the popular imagination. And it's influenced programs for millions of girls from countries like Liberia, Bangladesh, and Brazil, where I did my research. And the Nike Foundation branded this concept in 2008. And so really what I look at in my research is how and why are these companies investing in girls and women, and what are the effects for both girls and women, as well as for many of these corporations who have been often involved in ongoing public relations problems for their business practices.
Right. And let's get into that before we get into the effect of these philanthropic efforts. You say companies like Nike have had concerns raised about labor in developing countries, third world countries, people sometimes call them, sometimes hurting, people say, the very girls and women that these charitable efforts are supposed to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the book, I talk about this as a phenomenon of companies attempting to deal with or mitigate their public relations problems. So companies often begin to invest in poor girls and women while they are recovering from these public relations problems. So we can think about Nike sweatshop woes, as you mentioned, legal claims against ExxonMobil for environmental and human rights abuses, or class action lawsuits against Walmart for gender discrimination. So all of these companies have these significant business practice problems frequently involving female workers. And so I think we need to ask ourselves, are these companies taking up the cosmetics of gender equality without its substance? So they're really looking to invest in girls and women as a way to mitigate these, but then also as a way to invest in kind of long-term development in frontiers, geographies where they may not already have business.
So the motives you wonder about, but also you question kind of the philosophy itself, the idea that if we help girls and women in developing countries, there's, with just a little nudge, there's kind of a bootstrap effect that's going to make everybody happier and more prosperous.
Yeah, so in the book, I really work to challenge these common sense assumptions about investing in girls and women as a silver bullet for everything from solving global poverty to fighting global climate change. And I try to show how this corporate approach actually shifts the burden of global change onto poor girls and women in the global South. It positions them as disproportionately responsible for problems they didn't create, without actually addressing the real causes of poverty and inequality. So while solving these problems is really important, this approach is actually ineffective, as well as, I would argue, morally wrong. You know, we already know that poor girls and women are disproportionately bearing the costs of poverty. So then why are we also making them responsible for ending it?
Right. You point toward maybe more structural problems of the international economy, or maybe in one country of ineffective or corrupt government. Maybe is, you know, no matter what you do for girls and women, these are bigger problems that they're going to overcome.
Right. And so part of what I argue in the book is that perhaps instead of creating these individual solutions to solving poverty, which is really a larger structural problem, what if companies sought instead to address these unfair global trade policies, the unequal distribution of resources, insufficient state investment in education, health, and infrastructure? These are the kind of structural conditions that cause poverty, and they have to be resolved in order for us to have lasting change for girls and women and the poor around the world.
We're talking to Catherine Moeller, author of The Gender Effect. She's a professor at UW-Madison. Okay, so even if the motives aren't great and they're not tackling the whole problem, is there still a benefit? benefit if people are putting money and other resources into efforts to help girls and women living in poverty around the world?
Yeah, thanks so much. So, you know, through my field work at two NGOs in Brazil that were funded by the Nike Foundation, I show that while there were benefits for the young women in this program, such as bringing them together and creating kind of a safe space as well as possible future opportunities, that this corporate approach really leads to narrow forms of education. So forms of education that the executives or philanthropists creating this program would never design for their own children. So on one hand, I show how there was this focus on pushing back the age of pregnancy and marriage. This is part of this equation that has been put forward that you need to push pregnancy back in order to promote economic growth. And from a human rights perspective, we know that this is very problematic given the kind of long history of control over Black and brown girls and women's reproductive lives in the U.S. and globally. And then on the other hand, I show that these programs lead to a disproportionate emphasis on economic empowerment, so really trying to connect girls and women with economic assets. And what this translates into are really kind of narrow forms of education that focus on entrepreneurialism or training to be an administrative assistant or financial literacy, for example, rather than the kind of more holistic or transformative programs that the girls and women might have been desiring.
Yeah, talk about how, in practice, an educational program supported by corporate philanthropy actually educates.
Yeah, so the program I looked at had one kind of track was to become an administrative assistant, and the other track was to be an entrepreneur. And, you know, in one of my observations, we were in the classroom as the young women were just entering the program, and they went around the room and told us about what they wanted to be, and they wanted to be pharmacists, veterinarians, doctors. And then after this six-month kind of narrow program, they went around the same room and said what they wanted to be, and almost all of them said they wanted to be administrative assistants. And so we just think about what this form of kind of narrowing of education does as opposed to opening up future possibilities and new trajectories for the young women. It really kind of closed down their imagination of what they thought they could be.
Suppose someone out there is involved in this corporate philanthropy and really is well-intentioned. What would be a better starting point for a program?
Yeah, so, you know, I think these corporations and the individuals that are working within them genuinely want to serve girls and women. But I think first they need to think about how do you clean up your business practices at home and abroad that are putting girls and women at risk. So this includes safe working conditions, equitable living wages, allowing workers to organize across your supply chains, providing health insurance, as well as paying fair taxes in order to fortify public systems. And then, you know, in this Me Too moment, eliminating gender discrimination and sexual violence in the workplace. These types of actions would be far more sustainable, kind of long-term solutions for creating lasting change rather than these kind of short-term, quick-fix philanthropic programs.
I wanted to ask you about sustainability. When corporations set up these philanthropic arms, is there a sense that, okay, we're going in and we're trying to do something that's going to be here, you know, for decades? Or is it, okay, we've come in, we've done a good thing, hurrah?
Yeah, so in the case of the Nike Foundation, which was the kind of my primary case study, they invested in adolescent girls for 10 years total. But what I saw, particularly in Brazil, was that the investments in particular NGOs were only for 3 years, which is really kind of a short-term program. And, you know, oftentimes the NGOs and the foundation didn't have long-lasting relationships in these communities or to begin with, and then they would leave after three years. And so you see that there isn't really the long-term investment that's necessary to make transformative changes.
When I've talked to people on the show about international development or international health promotion, one case that I've heard made is It's great to have these great ideas from outside the culture you're working in, but can we do something more ground up? Go there and have people have a say in setting the agenda for what's going to help them the most. Is that out there? Is that happening?
Not in the programs that I was looking at. I think one of the main problems is that they were relying on individuals from the U.S. Who didn't have long-term relationships with these communities or even really the issue that they were addressing. And so I think what companies need to do if they want to be doing this work is to be working with women's rights and feminist organizations and other grassroots organizations that have been doing this work for decades and that have the solutions to the problems that are in their communities and in the broader global world.
And at the end of your book, it sounds like the opposite is happening. There's kind of a Silicon Valley model saying, let's keep doing this thing that you're raising concerns about, but bigger and faster.
Yeah, so I think there's really this attempt to scale up and to really attempt to reach more and more women as this kind of new global economic frontier. And so, you know, I ask questions about what does it mean to invest in poor girls and women in order to create a profit.
And do you see, as we start to wrap up, do you see bright spots, people who are kind of bucking this trend?
Yeah, so certainly within my research, there were, you know, feminists, educators, young women who were questioning what was going on, as well as philanthropists, powerful philanthropists in the community, as well as individuals working within these organizations and companies themselves.
We'll leave it there for now. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
I've been talking to Catherine Moeller. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies in the School of Education at UW-Madison. We've been talking about her new book. It's called The Gender Effect: Capitalism, Feminism, and the Corporate Politics of Development. Now, if you visit Milwaukee's Estabrook Park today, you'll find a dog park, a disc golf course, a lot of green space to relax in, even a beer garden. It's hard to imagine that this area was once home to one of the largest cement quarries in the United States. Our next guest wrote a book that uncovers some of Milwaukee's historical sites and treasures that have been lost to time, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. In Milwaukee or beyond, do you have a story from your community's past? Are you a fan of trying to tease out the history of that local landmark? Call in at 800-642-1234. Carl Swanson joins us now. He's the author of the new book, Lost Milwaukee. Carl, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, Carl, tell us what set you on the path of tracking down these lost treasures of Milwaukee.
Well, history's a hobby interest of mine, but I think there's more to it than that. I don't think you can separate a city from its history. If you want to really understand your community, you might as well just start at the beginning. The whole process of researching, it just fascinates me. It's like assembling a jigsaw puzzle. You know, piece by piece, you start to build up a picture. And in my case, you know, the more I learned, the more questions I asked, the more I wanted to know. It's a wonderful process. History is just an incredibly rewarding thing. It unfolds in surprising ways.
And you say the first piece of that puzzle you write was a concrete foundation you found deep in the woods near the Milwaukee River. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's I live in the River West neighborhood of Milwaukee, and that's kind of what started the whole process for me. I enjoy walking the paths along the river, and there's a very large and very old concrete foundation and set of steps, and it's kind of buried in the woods. It was a real mystery to me. I think a lot of your listeners who are longtime Milwaukeeans are shaking their heads because, well, they know what it is. But I did a little bit of looking into it and discovered that it was the remains of the Gordon Park Bathing Pavilion, and that Gordon Park used to have a very popular swimming area on the Milwaukee River. And, you know, the more I found out about it, the more I thought, wow, this is fascinating. And started to distill it down and make sense of it as a story in my own mind. And then I thought maybe other people would be interested in knowing these sorts of things. So I started a blog, and eventually the History Press contacted me and asked if I'd write the book Lost Milwaukee.
Let's get into some of the more sites. And there's so many in your book, it's hard to know where to start. Let's talk about the Schlitz Brewing Company. Talk about the rise and downfall, and then what is left there today.
Yeah, when you're talking about the things in Milwaukee that are no longer a big part of the city but were once a vast part of the city, I mean, Schlitz is one of the names that has to be right at the top of the list. It was an immense operation. Some years it vied for the number one brewery in the country. And now there's very little of it remains, just a few office buildings in downtown. But the story is an especially complicated one because they, of course, brewing is a very competitive thing. And they had a lot of issues going on. They were trying to cut costs with the product, and that didn't really work out at times. In fact, once they had to do a recall of the beer, their competition was fierce. Their marketing department kind of seemed to lose its way. The federal government launched a very expensive investigation against their marketing practices. And it's just, and then, you know, the CEO of the company unexpectedly passed away in the midst of all this. It's kind of one thing after another. They approached the workforce. They wanted concessions. They wanted pay cuts. Other brewers in town were giving raises. So the workers voted to strike, and that ended up being the end of Schlitz Brewing in Milwaukee.
And in the setup there, we mentioned Estabrook Park and the cement company. And cement, for a while, one form of cement was a huge business there, cement quarrying. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of the Milwaukee Cement Company?
Yes. It goes way back. And to a man in town who he is possibly the only person in Milwaukee who recognized the significance of some rock samples that were laying on the desk of the city engineer's office. They were building the foundations for the North Avenue Bridge, and these rock samples were sitting there. And George Berthelet looked at this. He was a man who made cement sewer pipe, and that meant that he had to deal with a cement quarry in Indiana and to have his pipe made. And he knew what natural cement looked like, and this was the stuff. And it was potentially extremely valuable. So he didn't want to broadcast this discovery. So he started quietly sort of poking around, looking for a place where the limestone cement ridge came close to the surface. And he found it in what is today Estabrook Park. And at the time, it was the world's largest cement quarry.
And then other means of making cement that weren't dependent on that one type came along. And then eventually this became one of the most dangerous swimming holes in the Midwest, right?
Yeah. Because they did quarry operations, they moved the bed of the Milwaukee River over to one side by building an earthen dike along the middle of the river. Then they mined out the bed of the river, which is where they found this cement limestone. Then they moved the river back where it was, but this left behind drop-offs and ledges and sudden holes, and it was just a particularly lethal place to go swimming. There was a place called Blue Hole, one of the lakes left behind on the west bank of the Milwaukee River, that had a particularly terrible reputation. Some people said it should properly be called Suicide Hole because it was just so dangerous.
Talking to Carl Swanson about his new book, Lost Milwaukee. He tracks down some of the lost treasures of the city. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Plover. Mark, hi.
Hey there. You know how big cities have neighborhoods, and each neighborhood has a history. My mother spends hours and hours and hours of her life on the other side of that spectrum. All these little communities out in the rural areas that used to exist. This is where the butcher shop was, and this is the church, and this was the grocery store, and that was the community. Those buildings don't exist anymore. Those businesses don't exist anymore, but those places exist in the memories, and she's writing the history books for all of these little communities.
Wow, Mark, thanks for sharing that. So, Craig, a kindred spirit doing something like you're doing for Milwaukee, but for a rural part of Wisconsin. But that's true in Milwaukee, too, right? There are these neighborhoods and communities and buildings that are part of the history that if you drive or walk around, you have no idea they were there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so glad that the caller's mother is preserving this history because, you know, it is incredibly important, I think, for us to understand our communities. We have to kind of understand how that community developed and grew and formed over time. And certainly it's true in Milwaukee that each neighborhood has its own distinct character and its own history and its own kind of folklore. And uncovering all of this stuff can be just an incredible detective story.
One story you uncovered along the way is something that we wouldn't think of now. We see bodies of water get iced up. That used to be a big part of the local economy. Can you tell us about the ice war of Milwaukee?
Yes, and you're absolutely right. Ice harvesting was a huge business in Milwaukee. It's a big city. It has major industries that at the time included meatpacking and brewing. All of these things needed ice to be kept cool before they had commercial refrigeration, and ice in enormous quantities. And so they had huge ice houses. Almost every community in Wisconsin had one. There were many of them in Milwaukee, including several on the Milwaukee River. And they had the dominant player in the Milwaukee market was Wisconsin Lakes Ice Company was the name of it. And they had 300 people working on the Milwaukee River, dead of winter, 1900. And here comes a steamboat with steel ice-breaking plates on it, smashing up the ice as it goes up and down the river, and it turned out to be owned by a rival ice company. And so that was kind of an aggressive business tactic. And the people that were working on the river, there were 300 people working there, and they depended on this for their livelihood to feed their families through the winter. So basically a full-scale riot ensued. Between the crew of the steamboat and these enraged ice harvesters on the surface of the Milwaukee River in wintertime, it lasted 6 weeks, and it was witnessed by thousands of people. The newspapers all reported on it, and today it's kind of a forgotten story.
Right. Now, this is dangerous for the people fighting out on the breaking up ice there, but add to the surreal element, on the boat it sounds like they had a brass band. And this was huge entertainment for people watching, for sure, a boat with a band and then a brawl on the ice.
Yeah, it had sort of the boat had a flimsy cover story. The captain of it told the press that he was trying to start a wintertime steamboat excursion service on the river.
Because who wouldn't want to go out on the river on the ice, yeah?
Oh, yeah, totally. Who doesn't want to get out in wintertime and stay on an open steamboat and watch ice being broken? But that's the reason why he had the band. That was sort of his cover story. But, yeah, they had a riot and a brass band going at the same time.
We're talking about Milwaukee's forgotten history with Carl Swanson, author of the new book Lost Milwaukee. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to share some history about your community, Milwaukee, or anywhere around the state? Is there that forgotten bit of lore, the old building that you know the story behind? Or do you know someone who's really involved in this, digging up the local secrets like that? Call in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about Milwaukee's history, too. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Carl Swanson, author of the new book Lost Milwaukee. We're learning about some of the historic sites in Milwaukee that have been lost to history and modern development. Carl, by the way, speaking tomorrow evening at 7 at Boswell Books in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or stories to share about Milwaukee's history or something in your own community, wherever you are around the state? And do you enjoy visiting historic sites around Wisconsin and maybe hearing those forgotten stories? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carl, before we go back to our callers, let's check out another story when Abraham Lincoln came to Milwaukee for the last time.
Yeah, Lincoln's debates with Stephen Douglas had won Lincoln national prominence. His anti-slavery, House Divided speech, it was widely republished and admired throughout the whole state. So it was only natural the directors of the Wisconsin State Fair invited him to come and speak in 1858. This was, of course, before he was president. It's a really funny story connected with that. Lincoln arrived in town after midnight, got to the Newell House Hotel, and the clerk told him that his room had been given to another person by mistake. So Lincoln told the clerk that he asked that a cot be placed next to the hotel's counter, and he told the clerk, "I have neither insomnia nor indigestion, and I shall sleep like a top." Lincoln's friend arrived the next morning to accompany him to the fairgrounds for his speech. And they found Lincoln shaving behind a folding screen in the lobby, and Lincoln was in high spirits. He had slept very well, and he thought the whole thing was just absolutely hilarious. He got to the fairgrounds and made his speech, which mostly talked about agricultural topics. It is the State Agricultural Society was his host, after all. But after the speech, I was really taken by sort of the human story of Lincoln and his friend Holt just strolling around the fairgrounds. And among other things, Lincoln took in a sideshow performance for a circus strongman, who's lifting big weights and he's throwing cannonballs. Lincoln thought this was great. He kept slapping his knee and saying, "By George." And after the show, he asked to meet the performer. And Holt described the performer as wide as he was tall. And Lincoln looked down at the much shorter man and said, "Why, I could lick salt off the top of your hat."
Oh, that's a story. Lincoln in Wisconsin. Let's go back to our callers now. Paul with us on the line in Cambridge. Paul, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm in the Cambridge Historic School Foundation, and something that our curator, Russ Amacher, has done is he's written books on the background of our heritage as far as what buildings were what. He has pictures from the past that were taken like in the 30s and 20s, and he stayed in the exact same space and took the same picture to show the there and now or now and then, and also the entire community around Cambridge. It's something that we really need to do is preserve the history of our community.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Craig, I got to say, I'm a sucker when people put next to each other those, here's a shot from 80 years ago, here's a shot from today, exactly the same spot. And you've got some of the older pictures of the Milwaukee area in there, in your book.
Oh, yeah. There's about 70 old photographs, many of them old-time postcards, a few images from the Wisconsin Historical Society, including an image of the ice war in progress. There's a special fascination to those old photos. You look at the way people dressed, and you see the city as it was, and it's mind-blowing. It's just an incredible experience to look through old photographs like that.
Paul, thanks for sharing that story about Cambridge. We'll go next to Richard in Menominee. Richard, hi.
Hello. I'm driving from 994 on my cell phone, so I hope you can hear me okay.
Loud and clear, Richard. Go for it.
I wanted to let you know that my aunt, Mamie Huffman, was born and raised on a dairy farm outside of Millsville, Wisconsin. She was born in 1893, and she, in the early 20s, she was on the staff of a very prominent family that was part of Pabst. Now, the name was not Pabst. They were in the steel business in Milwaukee, and I think the name started with a B, but they married into the Pabst family, and they were a big part of the Pabst at the time in their heyday. And my aunt could speak German, and she just raved how nice the people were that owned this mansion. So I was just wondering if you heard of that, of the extended Pabst family.
Thanks for the call, Richard. Craig, you've got a chapter on drinking Pabst in Whitefish Bay. I'm sure a lot of people were tied into that Pabst family one way or another.
Yeah, there were. And it's a fairly complex family history. But, certainly the experience that your caller just related is very much in keeping with what we know about Captain Frederick Pabst and his family. They were unusually kind, civic-minded people. And if you want me to, I can tell you a little bit about the resort they opened in Whitefish Bay.
Which, sure.
The Pabst Whitefish Bay, it was a beer garden. It covered 200 acres of land overlooking Lake Michigan. Captain Pabst opened the resort in 1889. It had a famous restaurant, hotel, dance hall, daily concerts with a famous band, amusement rides. It was a great location. It was just far enough away from downtown to escape from the heat and the smoke and the noise of the city, but close enough to be reachable by streetcar.
Or you could even board a steamboat in downtown Milwaukee, ride down the Milwaukee River out into the lake, north along the lake shore to the dock, and walk on up to the resort there. In its heyday, 10,000 people would visit the grounds on a typical Sunday.
Wow.
And, yeah, amazing place. But as time passed, the beer garden started to fall out of favor. The resort closed after its 1913 season.
Thanks for the call, Richard. We'll go next to Sandy with us in Mineral Point. Sandy, hi.
Hi. So I was born and raised in Madison, and as a Girl Scout, we did cleanup in the part of the Arboretum called the Lost City. And this was a part of the city where some very expensive lots were sold and some very expensive houses were built. And these very expensive houses had to be abandoned because they sunk into the marsh on the isthmus. So we would find all kinds of really cool stuff out there, foundations and such. And it was really interesting.
Sandy, thank you so much for sharing that. I have heard of that. And Craig, you're a big fan of finding the old foundations and then figuring out what their story was.
I know exactly what she means. That is just like I said, it's a detective story. It's one that you can do yourself. The internet certainly makes it easier to start to uncover some of these answers. But your local library, historical societies, these are all great resources and something that anybody could take advantage of and learn something about their own community.
Sandy, thanks for that call. Carl, as we start to wrap up, does it feel different to live in Milwaukee having done all the detective work you've done?
Yeah, it really does. It really does. It's a kind of a funny thing. I mean, it's really given me a new respect for the hardworking and inventive people that made this community. You think of Milwaukee, I find it a very pleasant place to live. I mean, for sure it's got a few problems, but it's a welcoming city, and you look back in its history and you start to see how that reputation was built over time by people that really cared about the city and really cared about each other. It's a very heartwarming story.
We'll leave it there, Carl. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Carl Swanson, author of the book Lost Milwaukee. It uncovers some of the historical sites and lost treasures from the city's past. And Carl is speaking tomorrow evening at 7 at Boswell Books there in Milwaukee.